You're listening to Air Schooner, listening that moves you. Hosted by Stacy Waite and Scott Winter.
I mean, I think for me, there's no separation between writing for the sake of writing and writing as activism. And for me, I think that a lot of that is I was an activist first and a writer second for a long time. I don't know that I wouldn't make that distinction now. But, you know, I came to queer activism first as a teenager, and I'd never written anything. I definitely wasn't somebody who wrote as a kid. And so I discovered writing through activism. And for me, the writing that I do is about creating spaces on the page for queer lives and queer bodies and queer experiences of the world and family and relationship that isn't there already. And so, you know, for me, that's what writing as activism looks like. It's about starting conversation and making space for stories that aren't outside in the world and other places.
He's Scott Winter.
And she's Stacy Waite. And that was writer Sassafras Lowry talking to us from her home in New York City. Today, we're talking to writers whose work demonstrates a commitment to queer activism.
We'll be talking to performance poet Kit Yan, essayist and scholar Katie Hogan, and of course, we'll be hearing more from Sassafras Lowry, the winner of the 2013 Emerging Writer Award from the Lambda Literary Foundation and the author of the novel Roving Pack. She's also the editor of the anthology Kicked Out, a book that gathers together stories of current and former homeless LGBTQ youth.
Here is Lowry, reading from the introduction to Kicked Out.
The streets steal stories, crush the bodies of boys and girls with molars of jagged concrete. I tried to remember who we wanted to be and where we came from before our names shriveled under the labels of at-risk, street-involved, runaways, throwaways, and trash. We were swallowed by systems incapable of digesting us. I collected the stories of my friends, repeated their truths like a chant when they moved on or disappeared. I wanted to pin down their lives, wanted their dreams to be remembered. Mark, who climbed out his bedroom window at 14, TJ whipped with a belt after being found with her fist inside her new stepsister before they ran away together. Princesses haunting bloodshot eyes and wide smile. Ghosts, blonde-haired, blue-eyed toddler. Crystals, kittens on leashes and dumpstered bagels. Sam, who drove all night, juiced up on truck stop coffee the day she escaped her parents. And the four of us crammed into one studio apartment with two cats, a dog, two ferrets, and our breath fogging the January windows. Those are only a fraction of the kids I considered family. No matter how hard I tried, I could never collect the stories fast enough. The details shifted away like Portland fog.
Lowry told me a little bit more about her own experience as a homeless queer youth and how the idea for this book came to her when she was 17.
The book first was an idea that I had when I was 17. I was a very nerdy, nerdy teenager, and about 2 days after I was kicked out, I went to the public library. I looked at every book that was on the shelf under homosexuality, and there was nothing that talked about like queer kids who were homeless or figuring out family, and I was really struck by how there was nothing and how much more alone I felt in that moment. And so I made this promise that if I survived, that I was going to make a book so that no other queer kid would feel as alone as I felt in that moment.
It's urgent that these stories get told, that more representations of gender and sexuality are produced. So part of the activism we're talking about today is how the sharing of these stories is a political and activist move.
You know, some writers I've known, Stacy, have been tentative to talk about their work as activism, as though it somehow could compromise their art. But performance poet Kit Yan seemed to also see his work as a writer and as an activist as deeply connected. And he talked to Stacy about what makes his activist work possible.
In my travels, I get to meet all sorts of people and see all sorts of folks doing activist work. And it's increasingly apparent to me that my activist work as a writer is not possible at all without the work of those who work in different other activist fields, in nonprofits, in unions, in communities, academics, folks, that our work is is very connected, and that the only way I can even be a performance poet doing my sort of activism is because of everybody else doing it out there, and all the tons of folks who were doing it way before I came along or any of us were here.
Kit Yan has been featured in the HBO documentary Asians Aloud and in the national magazine The Advocate, and in 2010 he was named the first Mr. Trans Man by Curve magazine. Most recently, his poems have appeared in Troubling the Line, Trans and Genderqueer Poetry and Poetics, which was published by Nightboat Books just this past year. He's also written for New York Magazine, Bitch Magazine, and Curve, and he's traveled all over the world performing poems that he sees very much as activism.
Kit Yan visited the University of Nebraska-Lincoln this fall for Gay and Lesbian History Month, and we were lucky enough to have him here in the Air Schooner studio. Here's Kit Yan performing a poem inspired by his little brother, Edwin.
So me and my little brother, Edwin, we've always gotten each other's backs. Sometimes I drive him to school, getting chips, taquitos, and Slurpees for breakfast. Sometimes we go to the beach when we're supposed to be doing homework, and sometimes we go out to eat, finishing our meal at Zippy's with two desserts every time we go. My parents don't let me watch him every day. I don't know why. He started getting my back when he was 5 and I was 20, with my baggy boys' clothes and fresh buzz, and Edwin, he was all Yu-Gi-Oh! And piano practice. And when the piano teacher asked my mother how many kids she has, she says, 2 boys and 1 girl. And when she says girl, she means me. And Edwin starts to scream, "No! Kid is a boy! Kid is a boy! Kid is a boy!" She says, okay. I have 3 sons. Since then, she's almost never said she or Laura, no matter how long my hair got or how tight my clothes fit. But Edwin, he gets it so easily. I was his sister, and now I'm his trans brother. We get each other at every stage. When he was 6, I asked him if he had a boyfriend or a girlfriend. He said, "Pfft. Ugh. I'm too small to have a boyfriend or a girlfriend." I said, okay. Silly question. A question that would have had my parents in a fit, but Edwin, he gets it so easily. He has endless possibility. And then he was 13, and he had a full schedule. Baseball practice, media homework, and his first school dance. And when I ask him on the phone if he knows that he should be nice to people, no matter what they're wearing or who they have crushes on, he says, "Oh, yes." And even though the kids have glee, I just want to make sure he never acts like Karofsky did in season 1, bullying others and holding too much inside, hiding his fear and hate. So over the cell phone waves, I tell him the things I wish I knew. "Hey, Edwin, you may not remember the things you did in school, but you remember how the other kids made you feel. And that's how they'll remember you too. So because you can choose, hey, choose, brah, to share your home lunch. If you need to punch something, make it a bag. And Edwin, don't be afraid to make mistakes, knowing that sometimes you gotta say sorry. And Edwin, if you want to try dancing with a boy, well, try it. But if you want to try dancing with a boy,
who I am,
and it's not safe,
I'm a queer person,
or right
I'm
now,
a trans person,
it's just a
I'm
scene
a person of
in
color,
your imagination,
an immigrant, a poor,
well, close your eyes,
come from a poor family,
give him a spin.
They're just things that
press
are part of you, so you can't
against
help
his
but write
breathe
about them. And those
that's
things
okay
affect
too
other people who
and
are
the same
like
goes if you
me
want to wear mom's clothes to school, or a suit, or a costume. They're all just costumes, so use them to make yourself feel beautiful. Well, I can see him on the other end of the line after an hour lecture. A little bit bored, but nodding to agree. See, Edwin, he's always been smarter than me, more generous, kind, and quick to share, and I wish I could be there to help him get ready for his first school dance, but I can already see him having the time of his life in his clean, crisp, new shirt, dancing in a big circle with all the other little keiki, like fireworks. I can't help who I am. Queer person, I'm a trans person, I'm a person of color, I'm an immigrant, I come from a poor family. They're just things that are part of you, so you can't help but write about them.
And those things affect other people who are like me.
Our third writer on the show today is Katie Hogan, who talked to Stacy from her home in Pennsylvania, where she is professor of English and chair of the Women's Studies program at Carlow University.
Hogan is the author of the book Women Take Care, Gender, Race, and the Culture of AIDS. But most recently, Hogan's attention has turned to questions of nature and ecology, and the ways that the notion of the natural is used as a political weapon to dehumanize queer people.
One is the idea that Peter Quigley has, and I cite it, is the idea of nature as a weapon of oppression, but also as a place to gather strength. And I think the tension between those two things is really important to keep in play and not to just focus on one or the other. To just talk about nature as a weapon of oppression is incredibly important when you're talking about queer, racial, ethnic minorities, and women. But it's also really important to keep that other piece so that you're being spacious, not eclipsing anything. And I think the whole project of queer ecology is to create more space and more possibility and more complexity, and to try to undo dualism. For LGBT people, I mean, it's amazing how much this against nature, unnatural, not natural, it's just saturating. I mean, today I just was reading a letter from the Archdiocese of Chicago in which the bishop says that there's God's nature, that marriage comes to us from nature, that the state and the church cannot interfere with nature. The issue of gay marriage is so contradictory and conflicted among activists, but when you look at how people in positions of power see gay marriage as like the destruction of the world, you really can see that legacy of seeing anyone who's different as, you know, not natural. I guess I'm still really shocked by how powerful that is.
Hogan's work is interested in theorizing nature as a concept, as a location, and as an experience. Her recent essay, Undoing Nature, Coalition Building as Queer Environmentalism, appeared in the collection Queer Ecologies, Sex, Nature, Politics, and Desire. Hogan explained the activist potential of rethinking and analyzing nature itself.
A friend of mine just sent me a YouTube of a wedding that took place in Lost River, West Virginia. It was so fascinating how the family members constructed the wedding. They would pair like the two men's suits outside in nature. It was just like perfect for like the kind of work that I'm looking at, because two white gay men getting married is pretty, at this point, conventional and sort of neoliberal, and, you know, it's not very radical. But it was really fascinating, the imagery of this wedding was pairing these, you know, the unnatural gayness with nature in almost every shot. So in that way it became, I wouldn't say radical, but it keeps this dialogue alive of, you know, the unnatural and the natural, and who decides and how powerful that legacy still is.
I think it's important to think about the connections between the kind of story sharing Sassafras Lowry and Kit Yan do in their work alongside the kind of theory work that Hogan does in her writing.
It seems clear that the ideas Hogan tries to interrogate have a lot to do with the reality of queer life in our society, for sure. As Kit Yan said earlier in the show, it does seem like writer activism needs to come from every direction. From poets, performers, novelists, academics, and policymakers.
Yeah, it's actually hard for me to imagine writing that isn't trying to bring about change. At the very least, change in perspective.
At least that's what we're all about here at Air Schooner.
That's right. We want to thank Sassafras Lowry, Kit Yan, and Katie Hogan for being on the show today.
And we want to thank you for listening to Air Schooner.
Air Schooner is a bi-weekly product of Prairie Schooner and produced with research support from Paul Hanson Clark and Marianne Kunkel. Production assistants are Catherine Larson, Franny Sprowls, and Nick White. Technical support comes from Rick Alloway of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's College of Journalism and Mass Communications. Air Schooner is co-produced by Scott Winter and Stacy Waite, and the brainchild of executive producer Kwame Dawes.